and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy. We strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. Our podcast explores topics that relationship-based therapists care about. In addition to featuring unique conversations and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. When it comes to working with kids and their parents in family therapy, the key to meaningful change is connection. Integrated attachment family therapy, developed by family therapy expert and attachment specialist and today's guest, Daphna Lender, is a powerful intervention approach that addresses a wide array of issues that make their way into our offices every day. Things like difficult behaviors on the part of the child, such as frequent arguments and tantrums, disobedience, defiance, indifference, and reactive behaviors on parts of the parent, such as yelling, pleading, threatening, giving up, or giving in. Instead of viewing the child as the problem, integrated attachment family therapy addresses the crux of the issue, which Daphna will talk about today in the podcast, is a misalignment in the parent-child relationship. In her work and on the show today, Daphna is going to walk our listeners through her framework, providing a therapeutic insight and wonderfully powerful clinical stories that go along with concrete strategies that are going to help you to help your families achieve meaningful and lasting change. Whether you're family therapist or a mental health professional working with children in any capacity, this is a must-listen show and a great clinical tool guide is Daphna's new book entitled Integrative Attachment Family Therapy. Daphna Lender, international trainer, clinical social worker and family therapist, and supervisor for practitioners who work with children and their family. She's a certified trainer and consultant in both TheraPlay and the dyadic developmental psychotherapy model, as well as being an EMDR certified therapist. Daphna's experience is drawn from over 25 years of working with families with difficult attachments in many settings, including after-school programs, therapeutic foster care, residential care, and currently in her private practice. As you can tell by listening today, Daphna's style is combining a lightheartedness with a profound sense of passionate energy and presence that she brings to every encounter. We will be back after the interview. Are you looking for a new resource to help clients navigate through familial relationships and trauma? The godmother of genograms, Monica McGoldrick, and family therapist Tracy Lesloffy are back with a new update on a classic genogram book, You Can Go Home Again. Readers of You Can Go Home Again are guided in constructing a genogram, a basic family tree which helps understand any complex family dynamic. This new edition also focuses on intergenerational trauma, the consequences of keeping and uncovering family secrets via DNA testing, and so much more. Use code HOME, that's H-O-M-E, at norton.com/homeagain for 20% off and free shipping on this new book. That's code HOME at norton.com/homeagain. This offer is valid through September 1st for U.S.-based customers and listeners of the AAMFT podcast. Eli, back with you on the AAMFT podcast. And Daphna, the first question always, if you're familiar with your shows, we like to know a little bit about the origin story of the expert, how you got interested in working with parents and kids and attachment theory. So how did it start?
Okay. First of all, great to be here. And I started as a social worker in therapeutic foster care. I basically took the first job out of social work school, didn't really know who I wanted to work with, and this job fell into my lap. I had worked with kids before, in fact, in my whole career before, as a babysitter. I can't call it a career, but I just gravitated to being a camp counselor, a babysitter, and a volunteer in after-school programs. It did connect with me to work with kids, but certainly not foster care specifically. And the therapeutic foster care program, what I had to do was take kids who were between ages of 6 to 12 years old who had lived in a residential program, which was part of the organization. They would have lived in a residential program for 2 years, up to 2 years. So really little kids, 6 to 12, living in a residential program because they were not fit, essentially, for living in a nuclear family like a foster family. They failed out. There were multiple behavioral problems, severe mental health issues. And after 2 years, the thought was I was going to be able to find them a therapeutic foster home long term. Maybe it would be a guardianship situation or adoptive family. And what we did, a really deep, what I thought was a very deep screening and preparation and training for these foster families or pre-adoptive families. Then when we placed the children in the home, we saw that the kids were pretty quickly acting out in such a way that got them back to square one. And the parents who were totally motivated turned into people who were just seemed completely different, hopeless, helpless, resentful of the kids. These are kids who are having behavior problems like cutting the drapes that the mom made by hand in the living room, or pooping in the corner of the living room, or abusing the family dog, okay, and things that you are hurting the other kids in the home, things that become really intolerable very quickly. And I felt completely useless and thought to myself, great, I went to social work school and invested all this time and money, and now I find out that I'm not fit for this job. It was really quick burnout. And I thought, I'll just become a mortgage broker. This was during a time when being a mortgage broker had high dividends.
So you were so burnt out, you were contemplating leaving the profession altogether.
Correct. And this is after 6 months or a year of being right out of grad school. Luckily, though, I had the opportunity, my organization let me essentially pick whatever training I wanted to pursue in order to hone my skills and get new experiences to help these families. And I, being in Chicago, met up with the TheraPlay Institute, which is a parent-child play therapy that is extremely structured and it's based on attachment theory. And so the idea, and Phyllis Booth and Ann Jernberg, Phyllis Booth is still alive today. She's 98, lives in Hyde Park and still working, which is just mind-blowing. But she and the late Ann Jernberg created, which is a parent and child play therapy model. And the idea is that it's really practical and very elemental. So what do you do with a child? What do you do with a baby? You play with them, you rock them, you hush them, you shush them, you stroke their back, you change their diaper, you watch them and make sure that they don't stick their finger in the light socket, you protect them. Those things are what they translated into the play therapy called TheraPlay. And so unlike other play therapies that may be focused, that were more centered on the child and allow the child to explore and use symbolic play. And the parent may or may not be in the room, but they're not the center of the play therapy experience. TheraPlay made sure that the parent was facing the child, sitting on the floor, playing and interacting and reading the child's nonverbal signals. A lot of times, kids who have behavior problems, right? They are 5 years old, 7 years old. They run away from you. They jump on your couch. They pull on the drapes. They hide under your desk. They pull on the electric cords. That's the kind of experience that people who work in play therapy, typically the new therapists, were completely freaked out by that because you look like a fool with a kid who is acting out and acting silly and chaotic, right? And so one of the roles of the therapist in TheraPlay is to really hold a very strong structure and bring activities with a lot of them and actually bring the activities, offer them rather than wait for the child to initiate them. And the idea is, I'm not the most interesting thing in the room, your parent is. So a TheraPlay room will have nothing in it in terms of activities like a sand tray, or they won't have dolls, dollhouses, puppets, because we want just the interactions, literally like playing patty cake and peekaboo and push me over and counting your toes and making funny faces and playing balloons, just passing on balloon back.
No accessories like traditional play therapy, a straight experiential parent-child interaction. Can you do that with two parents and a child too?
Yeah, you can. We typically work with one parent and the child because one of the ideas is that the attachment is specific for the child to her parent, right? To parent A, which she can have a specific and unique attachment classification or relationship with parent A and a different one with parent B. And for me, for a very practical reason, I like to work with one parent at a time. This is in general, this is not just related to TheraPlay, because I want to be able to isolate that subunit within the family system. And I believe that that parent can change the relationship with their child, regardless of whether or not there's generally triangulation going on at home or sibling issues and other systemic dynamics. It's just on a very practical level. Also, I get really overwhelmed by seeing all the dynamics between, let's say, if there's three clients in the room, and I don't know which energy is coming from which, where it started from, who it's bouncing off of. I can't keep track, even visually, of the nonverbal attunements that are going through between these people. They're subterranean. So I just like working with one parent and child.
And it makes sense because thinking of the dyadic level, because your attachment to each parental figure is slightly different. And certainly, where we both cut our teeth in Chicagoland, TheraPlay is very popular and certainly beyond that too. So you have a very effective model like that. Then what led to integrative attachment family therapy? Your model and your book, which we will talk about, which is a great resource for our listeners, but you evolved a lot of your training. What led to that evolution?
Right. So let me tell you that TheraPlay is a foundation because I need a parent and to be able to see what is going on with their child physiologically. And if they can't do that, then we're not attachment focused. So I don't do pure TheraPlay. I do integrative attachment family therapy. But let me illustrate a point to you. When a teenager comes into the room and they have their hood over their eyes and they're slumped on the side of the couch and the parent is sitting there staring at the kid, what is that telling us physiologically? That the child is shut down, that he is withdrawn and ashamed of something, or he is feeling really low energy and depressed. And then we have a parent who is, their eyes are beating down onto the child. And I have to be able to say, hey, mom, hold on a second. I'm going to notice something. Your boy here is looking really low energy. I don't know why. We don't know yet. We're not going to get into asking him to explain himself. But how about you take this pillow and I want you to face me more instead of facing your son. Take this pillow, put it around just on your lap and hug it with your holding it at your torso. Just to have something to do with your hands, something to press on, something. Can you take a breath with me? Because what I want to do is lower the intensity, and that's going to make it more possible for him to breathe as well. Since I can see that there's something going on between you two and that his state is low and yours is high. Okay. One of the principles of IAFT is the idea that I have to make the parent aware physiologically, not only of what their child is energy and what they're emanating, but also how they're interplaying with it and how they can adjust themselves in order to perhaps make more room for the child, or alternatively become more engaged more energetically with the child. And this, one of the things I do for an assessment is I literally have them play activities. It doesn't matter how old the child is. I still have them pass a balloon back and forth, just as an example. And I observe that. But going forward, what I know is, in addition to the physiologic attunement, One of the things that is really hard for parents that we really need to help parents and children do is talk about difficult things, really difficult things. I'm not talking about small behavior problems. I'm talking about the things that happen between a parent and child where, you know, because of an argument, the parent may walk away and swear and say, you know what, I am leaving this house. I am sick of this. Or a child may get so upset because they're dysregulated and they grab a knife and start wielding it in the kitchen and because their parent didn't let them go out past curfew or something like that. Those things, they have an origin much earlier in the relationship, the dysregulation, the fear. They don't get talked about. Once that episode is over, it's really hard to come back and talk about it without a facilitator. And so these things, they pile up on each other and recreate these rifts that make, that actually create insecure attachment.
So you can work from, as a traditional presenting problem, when a family therapist asks the parent and child while they're here, and they usually give a prototype or the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back that led them there. So you would use an event like that to explain and work with the physiological part. Whereas TheraPlay, we're thinking of young children. Integrative attachment family therapy, right, would work with young children through teens and their parent.
Absolutely. So how would I come up with something to work on? Sure, the presenting problem that the parent has called me up with is big, sort of, it's both the big thing, the straw that broke the camel's back, and it's also something that could be a superficial behavior. Typically it is. And that there's something much deeper underneath that I'm interested in having the parent and child be able to talk about. And I structure my sessions where there is a play and a relaxation piece at the beginning and end of sessions so that we are not coming in and sitting down and saying, okay, how was your week and what stressful thing happened? Let's talk about it. I want to make sure that we have something pleasurable and relaxing to do together. Okay, so whether it's balloons or whether it's throwing baskets into a hoop or whether it's sharing a snack together or making slime, you will be surprised. The children who are teenagers, they seek that aspect out. It's just that it's been lost for so long. And because of their age, teenagers, they stop playing with their parents because they feel embarrassed, because they feel rejected. But if you set that up, even after the initial bluster of this is stupid, a lot of teenagers are really game for playing with their parents. Okay, so so that's the beginning and end. So what do we do in the middle? I want to be able to talk about one stressful subject or theme and no more. So I want to make sure that we're not flooding the kid with a parent opening up and saying, he wasn't supposed to be on the iPad. He stole it from the cabinet where it's supposed to be hidden at night. And I came in and I took it away. He grabbed it. We got into this argument. He called me a name. I was like, okay, hold on now. Thank you for the introduction. I got you, Mom. All right. So let's go ahead and start with this theme, which is that we have you were unhappy and upset that you couldn't use your iPad. Something happened and you took your iPad. And then you got into this really unpleasant argument with your mom. Let's talk about, can you tell me about that kid? I'm talking to the kid. And during this time, I am essentially, with permission, because there are stages to the therapy. And the first stage, I have to prepare the parents what to expect. One of the things I have to tell them about is that I am going to listen and go deep with their child as to what is underneath the superficial behavior, like taking the iPad out of the cabinet. And at that time, I'm not going to let them jump in with their reasons and rationales and what their perspective is. And that's
while you're doing this, Daphne, are you doing this with the parent alone before you meet the child? Or are you doing this with child present, giving your structure to the session?
The parent alone. So there's five sessions at the beginning, at least. If I can't do five because I have a limited amount of time, I at least do three parent sessions at the beginning of the treatment, which is stage one. And that has to be the parent preparation and bonding sort of period, because I need to really work with the parents and get their trust.
You have to get their buy-in of how you are going to work experientially. So that's three sessions before you even meet the child.
Correct.
Okay. All right. What happens in those three sessions in addition to preparing them for your way of working?
The other aspect is to explain to them why I'm working. What is family therapy from an attachment perspective? So there's some tenets that they need to know. I'm super transparent about what I'm selling. And that is really important to me. This is something I think is, it's really underused, I think, to be able to be transparent and explicit about your methodology and your thought process with clients and let them be partners with you or decide that it's not going to work for them or decide that they want to try it out and they're on the fence, which is fine. I will happily work with them for a trial period. But one of the things that attachment theory tells us is the way you were raised in has a non-conscious imprint and will transmit to your child, whether or not you think you had a good experience or a negative experience. And that one of the tools we need to be able to use through talking about your own attachment history is the capacity to reflect on your experience and how it makes you react to your child, especially in those trigger points where you feel like you're activated by your child. Those are the times that your own attachment wounds are rearing their heads. And so by being able to use those elements, those themes as grist for the mill in our sessions, that is going to make it possible for you to be able to regulate yourself, to give yourself compassion as a child, as your child part, and then be able to see your current child and what they really need separate from your reactivity. That's one of the sessions, usually the second session. And if it's two parents, I need two separate sessions, is to essentially ask the adult attachment interview questions. But I need to explain to them the premise here and get their buy-in.
Yes, because that's essential. If you get somebody that says, okay, lady, I want you just to fix my kid. I don't understand why we have to talk so much about my background. It's really my kid is the problem, the traditional identified patient in family therapy. So this is not a fix my kid type of model. Much as we do as systemic thinkers, we expand the system, but it's very important for the parent to understand their piece in the family cycle very early on, as well as their own attachment history.
Yeah. And really, I know that some people don't want that. And they're shocked by it, and they truly believe that this is not their issue and that they don't have the time or the money. And I get those considerations. This is what I would say. I believe you that this isn't your fault. I also believe that you might think that this is a waste of time or not the most expedient use of your time. I am willing to work with you if you don't want to tell me about your attachment history. I will tell you, though, that I will be limited in my capacity to help because it's like tying one hand behind my back. Okay? That's how I would respond.
Yeah, I love it. We tell people as MFTs all the time, fix my kid model doesn't work. You have to have access to the whole system. And that could look like working with different parts of the system at different times. So you're speaking the language of our listeners.
For sure.
Yeah. You talk a lot about the really big problem between parents and children is this emotional misalignment. Tell us about that and the major reasons behind emotional misalignment between a parent and a child.
Okay. I used to work with kids who are in foster care, and the emotional misalignment comes from the fact that the kids were abused and neglected and they don't trust their foster parents because they're projecting their birth parents or previous parents who abused them. The foster parents are great, typically. But I have long understood that attachment issues are in every family, and that it is not about whether a child was abused and neglected and has attachment disorder. So here's an example. A child is born with ADHD and anxiety, super sensitive, reactive, labile. And let's say she's born to parents who are anxious and perfectionist, and maybe the mom had postpartum depression or something like that. And you start a cycle of feeling like the child feels like they're too much for the parent, that their behavior, their thoughts, their feelings, their wishes, their motivations don't overwhelming to the parent. And then we get into not just the thoughts and the feelings, but the behaviors too. A child with ADHD who is screaming at a birthday party or blaming a parent and an anxious parent, it is so hard not to be overwhelmed by that kind of child and to want to either retreat or then feel really guilty and be just very vacillating between just retreating and feeling guilty. There's a lot of patterns like that. Okay. And so one example that I just came across the other week with a client is this client, a 12-year-old girl who is, she tends to want to see shows and videos and things that are like supernatural, gory sci-fi. And she, because she has a very unique personality and she's very creative, and she sometimes doesn't have a capacity to really distinguish reality. So she'll embody certain characters and she'll have nihilistic thoughts and say suicidal things. Okay. And so her parents don't want her to watch certain. She feels that she is completely capable of, she identifies with these characters. They are meaningful to her. And she really gets a lot of enjoyment and meaning from watching this particular show. So her parents found out she was watching it. They took her iPad away. She grabbed it and they had a literal physical struggle. And when the mom finally walked out the door in exasperation, the girl threw the iPad and it hit the mom in the corner of her forehead. Okay. And this is the mom that walked out. The dad came in and was like, "What's going on?" And she said, I can't handle this. I'm leaving. Okay. And she swore. Now, those are the kind of things that happen frequently in this house. And that's the kind of thing that I want to be able to talk about, because this child is left with a feeling like, my parents think that I'm crazy. My parents don't understand how incredibly important this is to me to be able to connect with this character with whom I identify so much. I am a rotten kid for having this rage attack and grabbing my mom's hand and throwing the iPad. And also, my mom's going to leave me. I've driven her to the point where she's going to leave the family.
Yes, and they play out in this kind of routine. Sometimes this is one event. Sometimes it's a kind of series of pattern events that reinforce this message. So you meet with the parent alone. Then do you want to meet with the child alone before you put them together? Or what is the next staging in the integrative attachment family therapy?
After the first stage, which is that preparation and bonding stage with the parent, I meet with the parent and child together 3 times. And then every 4th session is a parent session only. That's adjustable for certain parents who need more frequent parent session only. But what I typically, all I need them to do for the dyadic session, once we get rolling, is I have an agreement with them that they're going to tell me one pleasant or good or positive thing that happened, and then one stressful thing that happened. And so it could be the parent might tell me or the child might tell me. But I will open this up and invite, especially if it's the parent, I'm going to have them stop after 3 or 4 sentences, right? Like I said, and I'm going to take it from there. In this instance, the mom told me that there was confusion about a show that she was allowed to watch or wasn't. And then they had an argument and it was really unpleasant because they had a fight and they both got hurt. And now the girl is really still really mad and is being really bitchy and making snarky remarks about how her parents are such jerks and things like that. And that's where we started.
We talked about what this would look like with smaller children, this idea of the parent literally getting on the ground, playing with them, doing something experiential. What if I have a teenager that's, I don't want to play with my parent, lady. I just want them to understand me more. And like, how do we deal with a teenager that is out of the play phase, more in the talk phase, and then these rituals that you establish in the room of connection through play?
Oh, sure. You don't have to play the play activities, although I will highlight again for our listeners that the kids want to play if they just are allowed to express their initial, like that this is ridiculous and this is stupid. I will just have just a playful attitude. Like I might just say, oh, you know what? Let me just throw this one of these fidget toys that have like sticky little hairy things on the ends and say, I'm going to throw this and see if it'll stick to your pants. And they'll just, I'm just throwing it randomly. I might do something like if they crack their knuckles, I might just be like, oh my God, you're so good at cracking your knuckles. Can you teach me how to do that? Or whatever they might bring in terms of I don't know, they might be good at soccer, so I'll just have them do some funny tricks with a soft Nerf soccer ball or something like that. It's more of an attitude of lightheartedness at times. And also, I got to tell you, having a drink and a snack is really important for teenagers. And it's non-traditional, and it's not meant to be like a reward for anything. It's actually drinking and eating together is one of the most basic attachment behaviors that, you know, mother and infant share. But we certainly don't have to, we're not necessarily going to play balloons with an older child if they're not into it.
Yeah. Tell us some other kind of key, either principles, ways of working, or specific interventions in the approach.
Sure. Okay. So if going back to the scenario of this girl who was upset that her parents wouldn't let her watch this show, I need to be able, with acceptance, empathy, and curiosity, and this comes from the work of Dan Hughes, who is one of my biggest, Phyllis Booth, I mentioned, is my mentor. I literally grew up at her knee. But Dan Hughes is also somebody who has essentially been my rabbi, my mentor. I follow him, and I'm a trainer in dyadic developmental psychotherapy, which is his model. And he created an attitude called PACE, which is playful, accepting, curious, and empathic. And it's a way of being with a child and parent to be able to allow them to go deeper in terms of what is the underlying motivation, what's the underlying fear or belief or wish. And so what I would do is I would turn to the child and I would talk to them with a lot of affect. Oh, wow. Acceptance. That would really suck if this show, tell me about this show. It's really meaningful to you. And then she said, yeah, this is, everybody's watching it and I'm not allowed to. And they're exactly blah, blah, blah. Wow. It's really important for you. Like, and the fact that, you know, you were watching it and then your mom came in and maybe you were right in the middle of it. And it maybe just felt, oh my God, I am going to lose it. Right. And so I'm going to be helping her to get underneath that it isn't just that she was disobedient and that she doesn't care what her parents think and that she's a violent kid who has rage attacks. And so what we got down to with acceptance, empathy, and curiosity, like the curious question, okay, is, she said something like, my parents just think I'm like so stupid that I'm going to act like this character and they don't know the difference between reality and what's real and what's pretend. I said, wow. Okay. And if that's the case, what do you think that means? What does that mean if your parents think of you that way? And she said that they think I'm crazy. I said, okay, that's really important for us to know that. And that makes a lot of sense why you're feeling like right now you're not able to talk to your parents and that there's a big rift between you at home. Because that really sucks if you think that really, I'm trying to think to talk in her language. And saying like things like that really sucks. And I think it's really important for you to be able to tell your mom and dad that. Okay. In this case, both parents were present my job is once we get to something deeper, which is that she is feeling like they are, you know, they don't, her perception of reality, right? And that she's crazy or something like that. That she be able to express that to them and that they be able to respond first and foremost with acceptance and empathy, which is something I train the parents. There's a sort of a psychoeducational piece. And I usually go in the third session with the parents in the preparation stage. I talk to them about PACE. I give them a hand about PACE. And I help them in the session to respond with acceptance and empathy. So I don't just say, okay, mom, what do you think about what your daughter just said, that she thinks she's afraid that you think that she's crazy and that you don't trust her? I don't just say, what do you think? I actually very much structure it. Mom, can you respond first with a statement or phrase of acceptance? What is a statement of acceptance? Thanks for telling me. It's really important for me to know what's on your mind and how you're experiencing that moment. That's acceptance.
Yeah, I love that. I think a lot of times what parents do, because they're out of their own anxious attachment or wiring, they don't listen first, which is a fundamental belief. Even a child, a teenager, they just want their parents to listen first without jumping in, being parental. And then some parents will say, I see my kid every day. I know everything about my kid. But you can see your child every day and lose curiosity and not have sense of their internal world. So these core principles of your approach that you're saying, it helps people, whether young or old, feel seen, feel heard. And this is also the staging of your approach, giving the psychoeducation, coaching the parent before they get in the real game situation in the room and then at home. I think it's pretty important to do that. What about parents that are reluctant or say, like, I can't be curious about my kids that are acting out. I can't be curious about a destructive behavior, or I can't just sit back and listen and be acceptant of things that could do harm to my child or to other people.
That means if you can't, then you can. I'm going to tell the parent, first of all, I don't want you to have to tolerate any destructive behavior. And if you are feeling threatened or you cannot protect yourself or your other child, let's go back to basics. How are we going to change the structure of your home? What do we need to do? Do we need to get a babysitter? Do we need to have him in an after-school program? Do we need to have your husband not work in the afternoon so that you're never alone with your child? I'm with you, okay? But after we've done all that and put in on all the structure and the consequences or whatever we need in place, I need to be able to help you to hear what your child is feeling underneath in order for you to get the cooperation that you want from your child. And I'm going to tell you that once we hear him and once we absolutely are with his, whatever his perception is, only part, he's only expressing part of the story. There is another part with his anger, his rage, his disgust towards you, his categorical rejection of you. If we accept and empathize with that without you taking it personally, I know that's really very easy to say and almost impossible to do, but that's why I support the parent so much in the session. I tell them, you're doing great. I got you. I make big hand gestures. Like, I'd be like, put my hand on my heart, be like, I got you. You're doing really good, to regulate the parent. But I tell them, if we can't do this piece of being able to really accept and see the part that he is feel so angry and rejected about, so disgusted by, and so shameful about, and if you can't provide that acceptance and empathy, we're going to be going around in the same behavior cycles all the time. And so this is what I have to offer. I also have a third stage. So when I talk about stages, Eli, one of the first stage is the preparation and bonding with a parent. The second stage is the dyadic work. There's a third stage. And that is working with the parents alone for a sequence of about 3 to 5 sessions somewhere in the middle of therapy. So after the journey has already begun and I'm well into the family situation and we all know each other really well, like after 2 or 3 months. What I do is I take a sequence of about 3 or 5 sessions to work with their parents alone, because I already understand by this time what their trigger points are, where they're not able to be that stronger, wiser, and kind attachment figure because they're reacting from their inner child. And so that third stage is focusing on the parent.
Yes. And what has been your response to that? Because a lot of times people are like, okay, you understand my attachment. Now I can communicate and play with my child better. So then to do the inner child work, do you pitch that? Because what if the parent says, no, I'm good, or I really don't want to do that? How do you get the buy-in to, because this really is a deep dyadic work, but it is really a large part of the adult really learning about themselves and gaining insight, not only to themselves as a parent, but what it was like for them as a child, in order to have a do-over in many ways with their own child, especially if they come from an insecure attachment style. So very powerful work if you can get to stage 3. And I'm curious how you segue and sell the moving to that part of the work.
The best way I've figured out how to do it is to tell the parents at the beginning that there are three stages, and that the third stage will be just with them for 3 to 5 sessions, and it'll come about 2 or 3 months after we begin the dyadic work.
Give us a powerful story here about stage 3 work that you have found meaningful.
Oh, I had a parent who essentially forced his son to, this was a family who came from far away from a farm, actually, and forced his son to work on the farm. And the kid was scared of horses. And I came to find out that no matter how much dyadic work we did and how many, I told the dad, you can't force him to work with the horses. It turns out that the kid said he also makes me go to sleep at night by myself and I'm scared. I need him to come sit with me and he won't. The kid is scared of the bus. There's a bully on the bus and the dad has no sympathy for that either. The rigidity and the sort of, this father was really had a very sarcastic and dismissive style. And when I realized that it was time for this third stage, I actually thought for sure he wasn't going to cooperate. He did. He came, but he put me down and was very derisive. Like it was about, you don't know what farm life is and where were you born? And he thought that I was implied all sorts of things. And it was really hard for me. First of all, I made a clinical error in the sense that at the beginning, in the first stage, because he was so blustery, I didn't ask him about his attachment history. Okay. So I went back and used the Dan Siegel's adaptation of the adult attachment history called the Question for Parent Self-Reflection. But it's essentially the same questions. And I was able to see his child self and his fragility and defenses. And he told me a story, kept defending his parent, his dad, his own father, and how wonderful he was. But he couldn't give any evidence of how kind and wonderful he was towards him. You could say what an upstanding member of the community he was. And I said, okay, what was one kind thing that he did? And the dad said something like, when we were in the combine and we were in the tractor, I could tell that he was really happy. Okay, so I was like, oh, okay. And how's that kind to you, right? He wasn't able to say anything at all that was where his father admired him or respected him or was close with him. But I sensed this longing to be close that he had. And then I said, there's another really important question, which is, how did your parents discipline you? And he said, oh, I have a good example of how my dad was kind to me, by the way. So I was like, oh, okay. So he switched back. He said, this is going to answer discipline and kind. He told me I got in trouble at school because I was at a science fair. I did a project and another kid had the same science project as me, but his was better. It had like light in it and his volcano. And this kid's dad was there helping him with the batteries. And so I got so pissed off and I kicked his volcano and was sent home and was suspended. And he said, I ran home, went, locked myself in the shed, and I knew my dad was going to put me in the shed. But when he came home and I was like sitting there in the shed, just waiting for him, he opened the door and said, if you're jealous of somebody's better work, you do better. You don't destroy their stuff. And he said, do you see how kind he is? I was like, wow, okay, I see. But what I'm reading into that is that you knew already that you were going to be punished and you had to go into the shed and that you were scared that your dad was going to come down really hard on you. And also I hear that you're saying that you're that kid who had the better science project, his dad was there and maybe you wanted your dad to be there. And that's why you were so upset. And this client really began to tear up and get emotional that he really was longing for his dad and that he wanted his admiration and that incident was a moment of tenderness in his eyes that was rarely demonstrated. That humanity and seeing him in his youth and what he was struggling with, that was the beginning of us being able to, and we worked not for five sessions, we worked for, I think it was more like 24 sessions together. He began to really soften up. He began to bring me tithings from his field. Literally, he brought me like a whole thing of corn, a whole bushel of corn one time. And then after that, he brought me pumpkins. And that was his love language. But I was able to help him see that I wasn't blaming his dad. He felt so protective of his dad. And that I was also seeing his point of view as a child and how he had to grow up being avoidant and not being able to rely on anybody and not being able to share his feelings at all, that none of that was legitimate. And he had feelings. He talked to me about wanting to be, that he was interested in theology and that his father put him down for that. And I said, you know, what maybe your son has brought, has come into your life in order to teach that you're able to stay with him and be close and share his thoughts and feelings and his perspective, his fears. And that could be something that he was, you know, brought into your life to learn that you can be close with somebody. So that really opened up a channel for him. And we went back to the dyadic sessions. And you know what the dad said? He said, I'm really scared of apologizing to my son for the things I've done because I'm afraid I'm going to do it over again and I feel like an idiot. Wow. I so appreciate your honesty and your vulnerability there.
You really helped that guy increase his understanding of himself and then take that back to his relationship with his son to be more in line with the type of father he wanted to be, which he probably couldn't have done without that third stage, even though you were successful in stage number two. I have just a couple of more questions. This idea of doing something both playful, light, and relaxing in every session, something experiential, no matter if it's a child or a teen. How do you bridge that in the room to the homework of doing the work between parent and child outside of session?
I'd love for the parents to practice pace at home. I'd love for them to be more playful and just find more opportunities to touch and to be lighthearted and to initiate just activities that don't involve being on the iPhone or everybody just being so focused on homework and get your schoolwork done and clean your room and things like that. I can't say that specifically I give homework. Some people are allergic to homework. I want to tell you what I find most valuable. When a parent has a child, any parent, they need gratification from being a parent in order to have motivation to continue to do the hard work. Because parenting is super hard. You give up so much. You sacrifice so much, right? It's like you have to be selfless.
Yeah, I'm a dad, and even good kids aren't programmed to give you the type of feedback. Sometimes parents need to fill their tank. So it is very important to get reinforced somewhere in order to keep going with sometimes thankless and tireless job of being a parent.
Yeah, and so here's something. First of all, I videotape my sessions. If I'm an expert at all in anything after 27 years, it's because I videotape all of my sessions. Okay, so let me put that down on the table, that's how I require my supervisees for supervision, that they
have a videotape. It's the greatest thing about MFT supervision, even though young trainees are sometimes anxious about watching your work. But if you get into that practice early in your work, I still do the same too, 24 years into my career, because I can always learn something. So yeah, hey, again, you're preaching to the choir. I love that you still do that.
Yeah. So one of the things I was able to do was a mom and a kid who the mom felt that the girl despised her, and we played an activity. I had it on video that the girl, it was an activity where the mom was, it's a funny activity from TheraPlay where you take lotion and put it on the child's arms and then you pretend to hold onto the arms, but you fall backwards because it's slippery. The mom fell backwards. This kid was 12, by the way. This is not a kid who's 5. And the girl literally laughed like a belly laugh, put her arms out towards the mom who was laying backwards, right? Imagine this, and clapped her hands like, come on, mom. And when I told the mom in a parent-only session, she really sought you out and really enjoyed you. The mom said, that's not true. That's not how I remember it. And I showed her part of the video.
Yeah, it becomes, the recording becomes an intervention to disprove the parent's negative belief of themselves or their child's view of them. Beautiful. So then after she saw it, did she get it?
You know what? She looked at it with shock and said, I think she's faking it. And I said, oh, wow. That is really interesting. I can believe you that you might doubt this, but look again and look in her eyes. Look at her eyes. That's something that you can't fake. And to me, it looked like she looked at it again. It was as if she was like, I don't know, birthing the child for a second time. She was like, could it be that she is really enjoying me? Yeah, it could be.
I love it. And Daphna, you are a wealth of knowledge. Your stories are rich and create powerful visuals. And you write much like you talk. I have read the book, 2023's Integrative Attachment Family Therapy. tell our listeners that have been excited and maybe you've turned them on to this way of working with children and teens from an attachment framework? Tell them what they will find in the book.
I am really into being very practical and very structural, like to lay out techniques and be as instructive as possible. So the book, I talked about the three stages. Talk in that book about how to do the three stages, how to do a lot of the interventions. I also talk about what it takes to be an attachment-inspired therapist, okay? So you are the tool, and I need you to know what you're bringing in terms of your movement, your tone of voice, your facial expressions. You are in charge of being the leader. And so that takes a lot of thought about how you are and what you're bringing. So you don't have to do it like me. I'm more energetic, silly, playful. You can be quiet, but you bet your bottom dollars you're going to have to be sitting closer. You're going to have to be leaning forward. You're going to have to be using your hands. You're going to have to learn to interrupt a parent. And I write about that. I write about that in the book.
It's just been wonderful. Many times our listeners will want to continue the dialogue. So tell us how they can do that.
Oh, okay. I have a website. It's my name, DaphnaLender.com. And I am offering a integrative attachment family therapy training, and that's on my website. It's 6 hours of recorded and 6 hours of live content. I also run a supervision group monthly. It's 2 hours. So it's 1 hour of watching somebody's case with videotape and 1 hour of role play skills group. So in small groups, and I hop in and out, I have some assistants. So it is the real deal. It's not just watching and listening and getting knowledge.
No, that's the way to do it. Do you still have space in those groups? How big are those groups of people?
Yeah, I keep it to about a group of 12 or 15, depending on how many assistants I have that day or that cohort. But I am opening another cohort shortly because the IFT training that's coming up in September is going to probably solicit some interest. There's a waiting list, then I take care of it.
Outstanding. Thank you so much. I have learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have too. Eli, back with you, bringing to close another successful installment of the AAMFT podcast, where we seek to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. Thank you very much, Daphna. Please check out the book. I cannot recommend it enough. We have a lot going on in AMFT and in the podcast world. So for all your latest news on AMFT, including the Summer Institutes in Seattle taking place in just a couple of weeks, and also the return to a face-to-face conference, the Systemic Therapy Conference in Orlando, and we'll be talking about more in months to come in November. You can check all of that out at aamft.org. Thanks, everyone, always, for your generous words of encouragement. And our show would not be where it is now if it not were for you, the listeners. We rely on your feedback. You can get a hold of me, Eli, at NorthstarCounselingCenter.com. You can go to EliKaram.com, that's K-A-R-A-M, where you can find out about everything I'm doing within AMFT and outside, including online trainings and two books that I have out right now, one aimed at helping you prepare for the licensure exam if you are getting ready for that, and another one based on the common factors that I wrote current AAMFT president-elect Dr. Adrian Blow. Did you know that AMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? You can also, in addition to listening to the podcast, follow the AMFT on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, wherever you go to find your favorite social media. We have 6 seasons worth of podcast that takes us from the movers and the shakers in the field of MFT to emerging topics that systemic therapists want to know about. You can follow us wherever you find your favorite podcast. I'm partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please leave us a star rating and a review to help us rise through the ranks of the Mental Health Podcast. Until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.